It is an old, a really old term, meaning monster deformed by lunar influence. It's like, so it's part of it is like, so the word calf, it means like a swelling, like, which is why like your, that's like the part of your leg is called a calf, because it's like this kind of like bulbous, like round part of a person's leg. And the reason a baby cow is called a calf is because it was thought, you know, back in like medieval times or whatever, that a baby cow would be born as like a shapeless lump, and the mother cow would like lick it into shape. And so like a baby cow deformed by the moon is a moon calf.
What's going on, Poya fam? If you are just tuning in, this is our special What's Up Wednesday on Moon Calf One, aka Sophie Campbell, and her path to becoming the head writer and artist on IDW's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Part one covered the development of a young storyteller into a professional, her early career and storytelling style, and what she thought was going to be her start working on a rebooted Turtles for Dark Horse.
Hope y'all have been enjoying part one of our conversation with Sophie Campbell, head writer and artist on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles right now. Part two promises to be just as dope.
Right. In Molding a Moon Calf, we explore how her work on Turtles helped develop the look and feel of the series, and how working on Turtles might have helped shape her into the storyteller ready to take the series on. And to do that, we need to jump like 5 years post-plot twist into 2012, when she finally gets her chance to work on Turtles.
Yo, Turtles editor and one of my favorite editors in comics, Bobby Curnow, found Sophie and asked her to hop on the Leo Micro series to do art, and just like that, Sophie was a part of the Turtles fam.
You know, back during the Leonardo micro issue, it was still like really early on, and there was like a lot of like approval process stuff, because, you know, the book was new. People, you know, didn't really know how it was going to go or how it was supposed to be. Things were still kind of being figured out, like in terms of tone and, you know, the look and stuff like that. And I was like losing sleep over stuff I wasn't happy with. And I just like, it was just too much pressure. Like every fan has kind of their own vision of how like the characters are supposed to be and how things are supposed to go. And I didn't feel like I could work on it and like be professional at the same time.
Now, Sophie is finally a part of the Turtles family. Right as the book is coming into its own, you know, making its stride, there's several artists have worked on the book in different parts and in different points of the story. The book began to develop its own feel, separate from the Eastman Laird art style. You know, it's really, really feeling like its own thing. Through City Fall, the fast-paced, high-octane action was both a defining characteristic for the series and exhausting to the Turtles and the people that created them. So after featuring several creators and introducing a ton of characters into their world, it was time to take a little step back and take inventory, see what's going on. And in order for the Turtles to slow down a little bit, they brought Sophie in to draw Northampton.
So the first time the Turtles visited Northampton, it was autumn. And the use of scenery and season was beyond brilliant. In the aftermath of the trauma-inducing confrontation with the Shredder, the Turtles needed to get away from the city, process, and grow. What better place to grow than a farm? What better time to change than autumn? So through the farm environment that allows a lot of space for the art and the Turtles to breathe, the leaves fall gently from the trees, and the Turtles get to reflect on some pretty big changes they've gone through.
And Sophie's art has a way of slowing things all the way down. And she gave the family the break they really, really needed. For 3.5 issues, there's no action, but there's also pain. You know what I'm saying? There's characters who have healed physically, but it's going to take a lot longer for them to cope with their psychological traumas. And the way she came on that book with some fire might be the reason they asked her to come on as the main series artist.
The first time, we had some fights on Northampton. Not drag out fights or whatever, but like stuff I wasn't happy with. And when they asked me back then, I was just like, I can't deal with it. And so I was like, I don't need that in my life. Like, I just want to, like, you know, I just want to sleep. I just want to have peace of mind. So I turned it down the first time.
What the shell? I think I'm going to need a moment to process what she just said. The Poyuth Pod will return right after a quick break. What's up, Poyuth fans? It's Lou, and I just wanted to hip y'all to a dope companion piece to this What's Up Wednesday. Those of you who follow me on Twitter may or may not know I'm a contributor to Panel by Panel or Panel X Panel, a monthly digital magazine looking at the themes, craft, and features that make comics such a unique medium for storytelling. In issue 43, our favorite comics of 2020, I get to cover some of the things about Sophie's first year on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that we didn't quite get to in these episodes. There's also some words on Wayward Kindred, The Oracle Code, Snapdragon, and some other really cool comics that came out in 2020. It's over 100 pages of beautifully laid out content on comics for only $3. So get your copy today. Now back to our regularly scheduled programming. What the shell? So first, Dark Horse doesn't get the bid, and then she says no? Wild.
Real wild, yo. Like, big, big wild. But timing just wasn't her time.
It really wasn't, because after Northampton, Sophie essentially goes dark for almost a year.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. She didn't really publish anything. Well, except for her Turtles fan comics. And man, I really wish we could get into it, but we really don't have the time.
Then she got to work and came back on the Gemini Holograms comic series and even introduced a new character to an iconic series. But we don't really have time to focus on that either.
Yeah, we got pack a lot in here. So what we do have time to talk about, though, is when she returned to this Turtles work. And I gotta ask her about a character near and dear to my heart, Oroku Karai.
I just wanted your take, Sophie, on a character that's near and dear to my heart who seems to be steeped in conflict, Karai. Like, how did you end up telling a story where Karai is endowed with the demon sword, but then also what was the idea that germinated for you to want to unpack Karai as a character?
Oh yeah, I love Karai. Me and Eric Burnham did Karai's path, and the stuff that we talked about with Karai at that point was she's kind of like brought low in a sense, and like in the very opening scene in that book, you know, Natsu beats her up and wins, and it's like Karai is like, you know, she's like a shark, and she like never stops moving, and like if she's slighted or beaten, you know, she's just gonna like keep going, and you know, until she just like crushes the obstacle or whatever. Like she can't just win. And in like Karai's path, you know, she gets the sword, but getting the sword is not enough by itself. She has to be like, okay, Ocho, giant demon mole, you're my goon now. And then she, like, when she runs into Natsu again, she can't just be like, oh, okay, like, there was a misunderstanding. You know, she, like, shoots her in the shoulder. And then is, you're my goon now, too. And I feel like, and I kind of try to, like, suggest things about her more than her, like, actively revealing them. And I kind of tried to do that with, in Karai's Path. I kind of tried to, like, have her in, like, other outfits and stuff. Cause, like, I feel like when she's always just in, like, her ninja gear, it just doesn't really say anything about her as a character.
Right.
And, like, you know, I would try to do stuff like in the end scene in Karai's Path where she's, like, doing the business meeting with, like, the other gang bosses and stuff. You know, I was like, well, you know, she's, why would she be in her ninja outfit during this? She would just look like a maniac. So, like, you know, she can, you know, she can give herself a kind of softness, and, like, I can suggest things about her as a character with, you know, what kind of top she's got on, or, you know, how she does her hair, like, that kind of thing. So, like, that's like most of how I try to, like, characterize her, because, you know, she's never going to talk about her feelings the way I write, like, some of the other characters. Like, she's never going to have, like, that heart to heart talk with somebody. It's always going to be, like, inside. I think it's kind of like, I don't know if it's moot now because the sword is gone, so she doesn't have her demon sword anymore. But, I feel, you know, which kind of sucks. I kind of wish she still had the demon sword. That was cool. But one of the things that I wanted to do with her and the magic sword was, like, so Koya and Bludgeon are, like, air and sea. And so that's why I wanted to introduce Ocho, the mole, because she would be land, right? Like, earth. And then that's why the magic sword has fire designs on it, because Karai is fire. And that's why it's red. And whenever I would do the magic coming off the sword, it would be like fire. I think in that sense, the demon sword reflects her personality, because, like, I feel like out of every character, she's just got fire in her, you know? And, like, she doesn't, you know, she doesn't half-ass anything. She's kind of, like, amoral in a way, not immoral, just, like outside of morality. She's, like, pure ethics. And that's kind of like fire, where it doesn't, it's not bad necessarily. It just burns. And I kind of feel like Karai is like that. I should play up the fire thing. Oh, and she even had fire, like, designs on, like, her ninja gear for a while.
Yo, so the elemental clip situation, like, I'm mad I didn't even catch that. Just crazy. We got our earth, we got our air, we got our fire with Karai and the sword, and we got water, you know what I'm saying, with Bludgeon. As an Avatar fan, I'm blown. I'm actually blown away. But I love it. I love that Sophie had that ingenuity, and that's where she wanted to go with it. Like, it just makes me appreciate her as an artist and a creator and a storyteller even more.
Yeah, it's definitely something that's in my headcanon now, and I hope they find a way to bring Ocho back and get Karai some type of fire. But I want to take a moment and hang on to that design work she did with Karai and her clothes and the dragon, and talk about another character that she got to design but couldn't talk about for years.
Oh, you're talking about Jenica, our fifth turtle. Spoilers. Sorry, not sorry. Y'all should have been picked up turtles.
Yup, their sister from another mister. The Turtles team made a risky move, expanding the roster by one, And in City at War, Splinter's Jonin, Jenica, is mutated in a move to save her life.
And we got to hear the story of a character that was 3 years in the making. 3 whole years!
And then, yeah, getting to design Jenny was, like, super awesome, obviously. And it was really just, like, a no-brainer for me, like, when I started to design her, because, like, I just knew exactly what she should look like. And, you know, Tom, you know, he came to me, and he had, like, the yellow idea already, which I had been doing already in my fan comic with my fifth turtle, Artemisia. Like, she had yellow face paint. And it was just kind of just like, well, I know exactly what this character should look like. And, you know, I finished it, like, really fast, and, you know, it's been great, like, how well Jenny's been received. I guess I thought it would just be a disaster in terms of, like, fan response originally. But yeah, it's been really good. There was, like, you know, like, an explosion of Jenica fan art, like, overnight, you know, and this has been really cool. It sucked in the beginning, too, because, like, I didn't know if Nickelodeon was going to greenlight it. So I had to, you know, so, like, I sent, you know, Tom was like, so I'm about to go into this pitch meeting with Nickelodeon. You know, can you give me, like, a design? And so, like, I whipped up some stuff, and then, you know, I had to wait. I don't remember how long I had to wait, but I'm just kind of, like, pacing or whatever, like, oh God, are they going to just shoot it down? Or, you know, I don't know. And, you know, like, luckily it was greenlit, but yeah. And then, like, yeah, cause I did. When did Jenny get mutated? Was it 2019?
Yeah.
Yeah. 2019. Yeah. So yeah, it was, yeah, it definitely sucks, like, having to wait, like, forever to, like, say something about it. And, like, even having, you know, this art that, like, I couldn't put out there because I had to wait. Yeah, it was definitely, I mean, like, after a bit, I kind of, like, got used to it. Just like, yeah, okay, I can't show anybody, but I will eventually. And yeah, but yeah, it was okay.
So, City at War. The story is an homage to the classic Mirage comic arc that ended the original run. And it's been done time and time again in different mutations of the Turtle story.
Right. And in the IDW universe, it also marks the end of Tom Waltz's prolific run as head writer for the series.
I feel like I keep throwing Tom under the bus, kind of. You know, I love Tom. And, you know, I remember when I read his proposal for City at War. And I finished it, and I was like, God damn, this is great. But I'm exhausted.
Bruh, the Turtles have been through a lot.
Yeah, that's right. Ninja, aliens, secret government agencies.
Yeah, evil corporations, other weird mutants, space.
And we didn't even get to the gods, reincarnation, like, no core, what?
So, the Turtles are in this very unique place where real time has passed, and we have to deal with the implications of that.
Yup. So, we sat with Sophie and did some fan math, you know what I'm saying, about how much time has passed in the Turtles' age. And I'm proud to say Lou and I were pretty damn close to what the Turtles team is thinking.
Yeah, the time, yeah, it's not like quite real time, but we definitely try to have, like, some kind of time pass. Like, when I was doing the Northampton stuff, like, I gave April's parents, like, Halloween decorations and stuff. Like, I wanted to suggest, you know, there was, like, some kind of season happening. But yeah, we haven't really, like, kept track of it. I kind of wish we did. like have like how many years exactly have passed since, you know, since like number one or whatever. I think in, I don't remember which issue it was. I think it was 112. I think I had Donatello say that they were mutated like 5 or 6 years ago, something like that. So I think that was kind of like me just making a call with like how much time has passed. Cause like 10 years definitely hasn't passed within the story. Like, even though that's how long the series has been going on.
I think what you said roughly aligns with my fan math, because there was 15 months before they found Raph.
Right.
And there was Christmas. And then there is City Fall. Then there is Technodrome. And then there's Christmas again. Then there's summer somewhere around 50. And then we're back at winter. And I think that like maths to 4.5 years.
Yeah, I think 5 or 6 years is probably safe. Because, like, I mean, this thing, you know, so much happens. Like, how could all that stuff happen in, like, any less time, really?
Yeah.
Then that begs the question, how much longer are they teenaged?
Yeah, it's really weird because, like, the IDW Turtles, like, they were kind of, like, instantly adults. There was no... there was no turtle tot period where they were kids for like, you know, 15 years, like living in the sewers. They were just kind of like instantly grown up. So like, they've only been mutants. Yeah. They've only been mutants for like, you know, 5 years or whatever. So like, are they, I guess they're, I don't know. Like, are they really teenagers? Like they're, I don't, yeah. The age is really weird. I think Bobby told me at one point that his kind of headcanon was like, you know, like Leo is like 19, Don is 18, Raph 17, Mikey 16, like that kind of thing. Okay. It's never like stated in the book, you know, how old they are like mentally. But I feel like, you know, they're not gonna technically be teenagers for much longer.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
Which I think Bobby's headcanon aligns with Lou and I, what we were thinking. We always thought by now, Leo, at least Leo we had would be like edging on to 20. So he'd be in the 19 range, you know, a college freshman, sophomore of thing.
Yeah, I agree.
So, with all of that aging and the need to slow down and take it all in, it makes sense that the Turtles retreat to Northampton.
And since they are slowing down, guess who they offered the gig to again?
The second time, what was I doing? It was less the pressure because, like, nowadays, you know, it's really smooth sailing with all the approvals and stuff. Like, there's never any big speed bumps or anything. But when Bobby, when he asked me to take over after Tom left the first time, I was working on, God, I can't even remember what I was working on at that point. What was I doing? I was working on something else, some creator own thing. And I was just, you know, I was like kind of deep into that and taking over the series after Tom and like writing and drawing. It sounded like too much. It sounded like a nightmare. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm just going to do this creator own thing. I'm going to finish this, you know, thanks though. That sounds cool. And then it was just like over the weekend or something. And I was just thinking about it. And like all the stuff I had always wanted to do with, you know, the IDW Turtles, like, you know, introduce Toka and Razar and, you know, introduce other characters I wanted to see or like, you know, take it in a certain direction, blah, blah, blah. And then I was just like, you know, I should probably do that. I should probably say yes to that job. And I emailed Bobby back, and, you know, luckily he hadn't approached anybody else, I guess, and the job was still available. And here we are.
Woo! She finally said yes. But that twofold responsibility was no joke. What has that writing and drawing double duty been like?
It's really fun. Like, I really love writing for myself, but it's really difficult on a monthly book. We write pretty far ahead. Like, I have, the next story arc, like the proposal and all that stuff is already written. So it's kind of like, it's difficult to, you know, like, for example, like, I'm drawing issue 115 right now. And then Bobby will be like, hey, you know, don't forget about the proposal for, you know, 118 to 122 or whatever. And just like, oh God. And I have to like kind of stop, you know, put this drawing down this one issue and kind of just like shift gears to like, you know, like 5 issues from now and be like, okay, now what's happening in the story? Like 5 issues from now. And then I got to like stop drawing. I got to focus on that for like a little bit and then like go back to drawing. And it's just like, it's really difficult for me to like switch gears. Yeah, it's like my scripts are really bare bones. It's like, you know, like this, you know, for this funeral page, it's basically like, you know, panel one, character standing around, panel two, close up on Leo, you know, panel three, close up on Mikey. And it's like really bare bones because like I know what it's going to look like when I write it. So I basically just have to write the scripts to turn in to Bobby and Nickelodeon so they know what's going on. But yeah, it's definitely something I can do on my own because it's like most of the writing is like on the page besides the stuff that I have to like send to the letterer. But, you know, I like the end result and I like, you know, I like drawing my own scripts and stuff. So, I don't know if I would do it again. I don't know. I feel like I would need to like really get a bunch of scripts in the can, you know, before I started drawing. Like, I feel like, cause there was like a gap where I wasn't drawing like last year and I'm just like really kicking myself. Cause I feel like I was just like taking my time with the scripts like over the summer and stuff and just kind of squandering the time when I wasn't drawing. And I wish I just like wrote like a ton of scripts, you know, and just like did it all, gotten it all out of the way before I had to start drawing again. But I guess that's always how it goes. It was always, you know, I'm always badly planning my time.
Yo, pulling double duty on a monthly like this, hard as shell, y'all. Many prolific artists have tried and many have failed.
Right. But I like this particularly for Sophie because that allows her to let the page breathe more. She's able to use micro expressions, space, and character acting to convey an idea in a way that would be more difficult if she wasn't doing both. And that's what we're going to talk about in part 3. The soap to our story arc. After learning about Sophie's storytelling style and how she sees the turtles in the IDW universe, we're just going to take some time in a denouement arc where we get to focus on the craft of Sophie's storytelling.
There's something kind of like serene about a really wide panel, especially one that's like kind of narrow vertically. Just like it lets the panel kind of breathe. And especially when you have just like one or two characters in it, you can have just like a lot of negative space and just really kind of focus on the character's eyes because like eyes are kind of horizontal.
What she's been doing.
And then Jenny's weapon, I thought a lot about her her Tekokagi claws, and hers is the only weapon that is like, it's like independent of her hands. Like, she doesn't have to hold it really, it just kind of hooks up like under her palm. And I felt like that is kind of like her, like